Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Tuesday, October 28th. Today we hear about research from the deep sea. A university lab focused on marine microbes expands our understanding of biology and ecology over the last 15 years. We hear about indigenous knowledge from two conservationists who have just completed a two-year marine science fellowship with the Nature Conservancy. We also take a closer look at our green goals and our oil dependency, and a recent report about after-school care and its affordability is on our radar. We take a closer look at the numbers. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. For a decade and a half, a shiny glass lab at the University of Hawaii at Manoa has been the center of science of the sea. It has helped us better understand the health of our Earth and its climate. This weekend marked the lab's 15th anniversary. We talked to David Carl, who has led the Seymour Lab in its microbial research, exploring the links with biology and ecology. He talked about the political climate and looking ahead to the next 15 years of research.
I think it'll just be harder. It'll be more competitive to get research grants funded, but they will still be funding oceanographic research.
I think I was there when you folks opened your lab, and it was a fabulous lab, right? LEED certified building, and your research is, you've done a lot over the last 15 years.
Yeah, we got funded to create the CMOR, the Center for Microbial Oceanography Research and Education, as a National Science Foundation Center of Excellence in Science Technology. That was 2006. At that time, my lab was housed in the Marine Science Building here on the Manoa campus, and we didn't have much space to expand. So that's where the UH administration really stepped up big time and made this plan for a remarkable extension to the Biomed building that would house our new research program. So this was in 2006. It took a couple years of planning and hiring an architect and raising the funds, but it did move forward. And then once we had the money in hand, it was a kind of a record time to build this facility, a 26,000 square foot research building that we call Seymour Hale. We opened it up in October of 2010, so we're just now past our 15-year anniversary. The original grant from the National Science Foundation actually ended in 2016. These are 10-year grants, no more, no less, from the National Science Foundation. And the expectation is that once the 10 years of investment is made from NSF, that the program will be able to find funding outside of the normal federal government funding stream. And we did just that. We had the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation, the Agaron Institute, and more recently the Simons Foundation in New York City provide funding for our research. So it continues today, even though the original Seymour grant from NSF ended, we are actually better funded and better positioned with a greater international partnership under the SCOPE program, the Simons Collaboration on Ocean Processes and Ecology that we created in 2014, and it's funded through 2028, so we have another couple years to go.
So what's on tap for the future? You folks have been studying microbial communities out on the ocean. I know we've done stories about Station Aloha, all these wonderful projects that you've got going. But what's on tap for the next 15 years?
Yeah, thank you for asking. The Hawaii Ocean Time Series program was created in 1988, if you can believe that. And since then, we've been going out to our station Aloha, which is 100 kilometers due north of Kuhuku Point on the island of Oahu. It's very deep water, and it's representative of the North Pacific subtropical gyres. We have been going out there as a sentinel to look at changes that occur in the ocean ecosystem over time. This would be due to things like ocean acidification, ocean warming, the loss of biodiversity, and so on. And these are processes that don't happen overnight. They, in fact, take decades to set up and to actually make the change. So if you're not looking at the ocean continuously, chances are you're not going to be able to observe these changes. So that was the original justification for setting up the time series site at Station Aloha. As I said, we've been going there since 1988, and we still are going roughly monthly. The cruise is out right now, as a matter of fact. They return to Honolulu tomorrow. And each cruise is about 5 or 6 days, and we sample the ocean, observe various phenomena. We take samples, bring them back to Manoa for analysis. And over this long period of time, we now have a baseline against which to measure future change. So you asked about the future. We hope that the Hawaii Ocean Time Series program will continue for at least another 15 years, if not longer. Some of these time series programs need to go on for 5 or 6 decades in order to see the changes that happen to the ecology in the ocean. I will be facing retirement at some point, but we have trained a large number of leaders who are now running their own labs and are also part of the programs that we've built as a foundation here. So there will be plenty of talent and plenty of new students and postdocs to carry on the work.
We just did something recently about the research, and it's a long-running research in the atmospheric science up in Mauna Loa, and the concerns about halting that data collection. And so it's just so important when you have these long-term projects, we can learn so much. And if there is a shortfall or a lapse in funding, it's not good.
Catherine, I'm glad you mentioned the Mauna Loa Observatory, because we argue that the Station Aloha is the oceanic equivalent, the twin of the Mauna Loa Observatory, which actually was started in 1958 and continues to this day. I am a board member of the Keeling Curve Foundation, which oversees the analysis at the Mauna Loa Observatory, and we are very concerned about the future of that long time series, as well as many other what we call LTOs, long-term observations of the Earth. And we have a list of about 15 or 20 of these critical measurements, critical time series around the world that are now under risk for losing their funding from the federal government, at least in the U.S. And we have mounted a campaign to try to raise philanthropic support from private industry, private foundations, private individuals to carry out these analyses when and if the federal government should terminate any of these critical long-term observations.
It's interesting to see the folks over at the medical school, right, are looking for other types of funding. When the National Science Foundation money dries up, do they look for money at the pharmaceutical companies? But I guess in your world, I don't know, are there those types of deep pockets?
There is a marine-based industry, but it's not a very large one, especially for the basic research that we do. So we would turn instead to private wealthy individuals and their foundations as the best hope for raising awareness and then raising funds for the work that we have been doing. We don't have equivalent of the pharmaceutical industry in the medical field. I wish we did. And of course, we've got oil and gas, but that's not an industry that we would promote. So we don't turn to them for funding. This is the same thing for deep sea mineral mining. That's another marine industry that is likely to accelerate in pace during the current administration, but it's got many unknowns and many potential environmental consequences that we probably would not promote that. In fact, Governor Green has signed a moratorium on deep sea mining within territorial waters of Hawaii.
Is there anything, though, of the research projects that you've been involved in that can open up a dimension about the deep sea mining, you know, either for or against, of just based on good science?
Absolutely. The people here at the Manoa are some of the world's experts in the geochemistry of deep sea minerals, especially nodules and plates. So this is something that there is a great opportunity, I think, for learning, for doing some of the basic research that will be necessary in order for this industry to thrive and to deal with the environmental consequences. This goes for other carbon sequestration processes such as ocean alkalinity changes and ocean fertilization with iron. These are potential ways in which we can ameliorate the effects of greenhouse gas warming, but nothing comes without environmental consequence. So you're absolutely right. The university community needs to be positioned as experts in this area and be the honest brokers for science and technology and new information about these processes.
Did you lose any funding this year at all?
I haven't lost any funding, but people in our school certainly have, especially funding from Office of Naval Research and from NOAA funding.
Yeah, it is a concern for our researchers. Anything else that you think would be important to underscore as you mark this anniversary?
The one thing that I have a background in public high school teaching, and I've been my entire career been interested in public education. And I think now is the time to have a new push for informing the general public. They're the taxpayers, they're the voters, and they need to go into a voting booth with all information that they can possibly have on the complex issues revolving science and technology. So I'm hope in my final career here at UH, hope to get much more involved in public education.
We see a lot of articles about, oh, we've reached a tipping point with our glaciers melting and the changes in the ocean. And then we have all this climate denying politics. Challenging times for science.
It's challenging times, and it's challenging even for the experts in the field because there's legitimate differences of opinion. So you can imagine what the general public with a nominal background in the basic science, there's no way that they can possibly assimilate all the necessary information to make an informed judgment. And that's what I think is a major role for scientists to play.
That was University of Hawaii's Seymour Lab Director David Carl, who we talked to yesterday afternoon about the groundbreaking research that he's been involved in at the university campus.
Young Americans are taking their own lives at a much higher rate than a decade ago, up 20% for people 18 to 27.
To be able to transition from my purpose being school to what is my purpose now as a more independent individual is so complicated and becoming more complicated.
Why is it happening? That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Hey there, it's Sabrina Tavernisi, host of The Daily. Join us for an in-depth look at the world's biggest stories as they happen. Catch The Daily Monday through Thursday evenings at 6:30 here on HPR One.
We are keeping on this thread of marine science as we turn our attention to the Nature Conservancy. Today, we hear from two researchers, Hawaii Pacific University alum Colin Aldridge and Kailea Duriano. They just completed a two-year marine science fellowship working on indigenous leadership and indigenous data policy. Duriano starts us off.
The Marine Fellowship Program is basically a program that encourages emerging professionals to join in and be housed under the Hawaii and Palmyra business unit. The Nature Conservancy, it's global, and we have a bunch of business units all across the world. So this fellowship program has been around. 2008, 2009 was the first cohort. So me and Colin are actually the eighth cohort to complete this fellowship. The first year is basically a chance to dive into community-led projects across the Hawaii Islands. Now, we are Marine Fellows, so our work is in marine conservation, but there's plenty of overlap that we do with our terrestrial team as well. Based on our experiences in the first year of the fellowship, we get to kind of choose a project that we feel passionate about that aids in marine conservation efforts within the Hawaii and Palmyra BU. And for my project, I was really interested in this concept of indigenous data sovereignty. I kind of came to that an idea of working with community members and just honestly, in full transparency, hearing the experiences of kupuna ancestors, yeah, elders who have really are very exhausted of constantly having to share knowledge and exchange and not feeling that the reciprocal relationship between sharing knowledge to outside organizations or people are really benefiting the Native Hawaiian communities here. So I came to the Nature Conservancy and was like, hi, we're doing a lot of indigenous data work, which is data that's for, about, or alongside indigenous communities, their lands and environments, territories, and their well-being. We do a lot of indigenous work, especially in Hawaii, in conservation here, but we don't have indigenous data sovereignty principles or guidelines. And Nature Conservancy was like, oh my gosh, you are so right. Let's go ahead and go move through with this process. So for the last year, I've traveled all over the world in learning and researching indigenous data sovereignty and making sure our Hawaii chapter and the Nature Conservancy has up-to-date ethical data practices.
And then, Colin, talk about what you focused on.
Yeah, so for my project, it's very similar to Kailea's, also really including like data and indigenous communities and people. But mine was more focused on what we call at TNC right relations, which is essentially working like collaboratively, ethically, and working to decolonize your approaches and making sure relationships with communities are healthy. And so that's at every step, including communities from just coming up with their research questions, actually doing the research itself, and then, of course, sharing that information back as well. But yeah, it's really focused on relationships, which made it a little difficult to kind of conceptualize. But it basically is a way to make sure that you're not being extractive in your relationships with the community. So making sure that you're actually working with that community and in that community, including them at every step, giving them opportunities to give you feedback, making sure they understand what the research is, what you're doing, and how that is affecting them and their processes that are happening in their environments.
So what got you interested in this area?
Yeah, so a little bit just from my own background too. I mean, I'm African-American and Native American, so it's kind of within my values. But also I'm a scientist, like my background's in marine biology. So it was just a very natural blend of like my two bigger passions into one thing. And it's something that was already starting at TNC and through relationships that Kailea and I built with global teams at TNC that do this on like a global scale. I was able to help do this in like a Hawaii lens and context.
I know this political climate is not so friendly to diversity, yeah, and equity. And I don't know, how do you see that as a filter to the science that you folks are interested in exploring?
That was a really big research topic within looking into indigenous sovereignty, because again, it's a global movement, but it has different approaches based on the government that's involved in. And I mean, we saw it at the Nature Conservancy and here in our chapter of the effects of the federal administration. And really, I think naturally as well, it couldn't have been a better fellowship opportunity for us to go into indigenous right relations because of everything that is happening and really focus on community-led conservation for sure. And indigenous sovereignty, it's really perpetuated by UNDRIP, which is the United Nations Declaration of Rights for Indigenous Peoples. It's really pushing this idea that when federal lacks the support and recognition of indigenous people, then the state and community can use on drip as a mechanism to really perpetuate this work. So I think naturally, seeing everything that's going around in our country, how much it affects conservation and science, the data being withheld or not shared, misconstrued, it's so important to push this idea that people should know data, and especially the indigenous people of place who are we working with, because we see it in conservation that without indigenous people's help, a lot of conservation goals would not be met.
We've had groups in on our show. I know there was one, the Limu Hui folks, they traveled to, I think it was Alaska or Pacific Northwest area, to learn about the clam gardens, you know, from the Native Americans, you know. And it was just an interesting way to be able to see what they do versus what we do with our fish ponds, you know, and growing limu to attract the fish. Is there anything that you can share just on the Native tribes aspect and the indigenous knowledge that they hold?
Yeah, I mean, well, honestly, like, what I've found, especially these last 2 years, has just been a lot of reaffirmations for me that, like, there's learning we all can do from each other as indigenous people. Obviously, every place, like every coastline, every ahuwa, every beach is different. But these tools that are being used to work against us and work our progression as far as our goals is like colonization efforts and things, they're all the same. It's the same tools used in different places and affects it in different ways. But when we work with each other and talk to each other, we can see that there's a lot more things that combine us and like overlap than that divide us. So there's been a whole bunch of really awesome momentum and things like IDS, like Kylie has been talking about, and also just in general with people traveling to other people's places and learning with each other and reconnecting. For example, at HCC last year, there was a bunch of Southeast Alaskans that came to the White Conservation Conference in 2024. And being in that forum, you got to hear a whole bunch of like seeing the differences like sovereignty versus non-sovereignty and just how that's so different, or how sovereignty is very different in Hawaii in general. Like the way it's expressed and used is very different than it is through federal recognition like a First Nation or tribe. But again, like the ways that we can take these things like IRR and IDS and use them to our own advantages to be able to learn from each other and to make sure that research is done ethically and that data is kept as sovereign and kept sacred is very impressive. Like, it's amazing seeing that there's so much overlap in all these different stories with these different people.
So where do you want to take this? I mean, will you go back to Texas to work on projects? Where do you want to go next?
Well, I would love to go anywhere back to where my peoples have been. I just think that, like, again, like learning in a place like here, like in Hawaii, and being so privileged to have been here for the last several years and being able to give back in ways that are very unique with the tools that I had, I think it'd be really great to go back. I am hoping and planning to go back to the States soon. I'm kind of in the process actually of waiting on a couple jobs, waiting to hear back, but very hopeful that I'll be able to get back to my own people.
And what about you? What's next for you?
Yeah. So my fiance currently also works in environmental and recently got a job in the Pacific Northwest. And I think researching so much into indigenous sovereignty, I want to go back into school. So I, same like Colin, I graduated with marine biology and oceanography. So I have the science component down for indigenous data, but I really want to learn more about the law and policy. So we're actually going to be moving to the Pacific Northwest in Oregon following his job, but also for the career opportunities and to possibly go to grad school in indigenous law and studies.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's just so fascinating because of the whole political relationship with the federal government, with Native tribes and Native Hawaiians. And then you shared that you're also part Native American. And so, yeah, it's just fascinating to see, yeah, then where this could take you and what experiences that you can, you know, get into to grow.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's the thing that was a big strength for both Colin and I, is that, you know, especially in Hawaii and just in the United States, we're such a mixed nationality as people. Yeah. We have so many different ancestral bloodlines that come through each individual person. And I think exploring through this fellowship that gave me the opportunity to go to Australia, to go to Sweden, to go to these places and meet other indigenous people and reconnect to our own identities through that as well. Every indigenous people are at different parts of the reclamation of their identity and their cultural lifestyles. So I'm just excited for that next chapter and see. But of course, being a Kanaka Maoli, my home is always going to be here. And I have that strengthened and deepened because of this fellowship and meeting other indigenous peoples.
So I take it that you see this diversity as a strength.
Oh, absolutely.
Anything else you want to share with our listeners just about the opportunities that you've had with this fellowship with the Nature Conservancy?
Oh, man, it's been a crazy 2 years with the fellowship. I mean, the fact that programs like that even exist here, I think, is a testament to the work and the effort that's been put in Hawaii to prioritize, like, youth and Indigenous leadership. And I think it's really amazing that something like that can get Kailea and I in a position like this right now, where we're, like, on HPR and able to do this interview and put our stories out there a little bit. And, yeah, I'm just incredibly grateful to have had not only the 2 years with TNC in Hawaii, but my past, like, 6 years that I've been here in Hawaii have been transformative. And again, like, I knew my time was going to be brief here, but I could not have been more privileged and honored to have been here and learned from such incredible people and to see the strength of the Kanaka Maoli and the pride. Yeah, I've learned things that are going to transform me for the rest of my life, and I'm extremely excited for the next steps.
Well, thank you both for carving out time with your busy schedules and sharing your story. And good luck to both of you.
Thank you so much.
That was Kailea Duriano and Colin Aldridge, who just completed a 2-year fellowship with the Nature Conservancy. You know, we hear a lot about our state's green energy goals, but how do we stack up against other states in terms of our oil dependency? Honolulu Civil Beats reporter Stuart Yurton joins us this morning to take a closer look. Good morning, Stuart.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so I understand that this story grew out of another one that you did when the governor announced a deal with a Japanese company on liquefied natural gas.
Yes, that's right. So we had just reported on the deal between state governor's office and JERA, the Japanese oil natural gas company, and it came up during that discussion, the question of how much oil do we use? We were touted as the state that uses the most petroleum to generate electricity. So we looked at it. We looked at the latest numbers from the U.S. Department of Energy. And yes, that number is absolutely correct. We use a lot of oil, way more than other states.
Yeah, I mean, we're like double digits, right?
Yeah, so we looked at a snapshot in time with the data from the Department of Energy, Energy Information Administration, and we saw the numbers for July of 2025 were 71% of our electricity came from petroleum, and during the month only 24% came from renewables, solar, wind, other things. So it's a big disparity there. Meanwhile, if you looked at other states like California, it was generating something like close to 60% with renewables, including solar, wind, and they have hydroelectricity too. So we're really behind other states when it comes to renewables, including, you know, other leaders like Florida and Texas. Texas uses a lot of wind. So, yeah, those were the numbers. And again, the statement that we use far more petroleum to generate electricity than any other state is checked out.
Yeah, and you know, I know that the whole idea of liquefied natural gas isn't something that sits well with a lot of environmental groups because they just see it as prolonging our dependence.
Yeah, there are a couple of issues there, right? The thought is it would prolong our dependence even if we went with natural gas, again, liquefied. Natural gas can be shipped across the ocean, brought here by ship, and then regasified at a terminal offshore, and then pipelined in onshore for generators. So the thought is all that infrastructure would be such an investment that it would just stay there, and it would prevent us from moving to renewables. The other issue is that while natural gas burns more cleanly than oil, so it doesn't generate as much carbon emissions, The concern is that it is methane, which is a very harmful greenhouse gas, and when there are leaks during the life cycle of the gas, when it's mined or shipped or anything else, that methane offsets the benefits of the natural gas when it's actually burned. So those are the concerns. The State Energy Office says, yes, it can be bad, but when handled correctly and in coming from countries that have regulations in place to prevent that, it's better, even considering the life cycle emissions.
Yes, and Governor Green, I know, has been open to the use of liquefied natural gas, where Governor David Ige was not.
Right, that's right. So it's gone back and forth. Governor Abercrombie really wanted it. Governor Ige said no. It'll distract from our renewables policy, and Governor Green has said renewables are really important. We want to keep doing those, but it has to be a mix of sources, and LNG has to be part of that mix.
Yeah, it's just interesting, just because the political climate around green energy and our goals, even though the state is pushing it, I know there's just less federal money available for projects.
Well, yeah, that's right, too. So this LNG deal really dovetails with what the Trump administration wants. They just entered a big deal with JERA, where the U.S. Department of Interior entered the deal to sell a bunch of LNG to JERA over long-term contracts. It's a big deal for the Trump administration, and it would fit in with this whole plan that Governor Green announced a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much, Stuart.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was Stuart Yurton, who's been tracking our dependence on oil in a recent business deal struck with a Japanese company over natural liquefied gas. Look for his stories at sybilbeat.org.
Live from the Atherton presents Celebrate 808, a month-long series highlighting the sounds and soul of Hawaii. Every Saturday starting November 8th, we're celebrating local music with HPR's own Bridging the Gap DJs, alongside artists Stephen Henderson, Kala'e Parrish, and Isaac. Step into the Atherton, live, local, and tune in with the 808. Tickets and details at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by HMSA.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, soccer leagues around the world use a promotion and relegation system to reward the best teams and punish the worst.
It's great for fans of teams outside the major leagues. It's fantastic for competitive balance.
So, would American fans benefit if the best college teams could make it to the pros? That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
Beginning this evening at 7.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Today, we're taking a trip down memory lane to visit some of the oldest restaurants in Hawaii. The Tip Top on Kauai and the Monago Hotel Restaurant on the island of Hawaii have each served customers for more than a century. Today, we're looking for a relatively younger establishment that holds the title for oldest continuously operated restaurant on Oahu. This eatery was founded by brothers Richard and Henry Chagami in 1947. Richard served as a cook in the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. And when the brothers returned home from war, they purchased a lunch wagon and initially served banana splits, ice cream, floats, and sodas. They gave it a name that was reminiscent of California's gold rush, hoping to entice customers to rush into their diner. This restaurant is also claimed to be the first to serve pancakes with haupia sauce and macadamia nuts. For today's quiz, can you tell us the name of the oldest continuously operated restaurant on Oahu? Call 808-941-3689 or toll free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right wins a reusable HPR tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are working to provide affordable housing programs to transition renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NareitHawaii.com.
Are you passionate about local journalism, skilled at identifying a range of voices and perspectives? HPR is hiring a full-time producer to work on The Conversation, our flagship daily news and talk show. Read the full job description and apply at hawaiipublicradio.org/jobs.
Support for HPR comes from Big Island Coffee Roasters, featuring 100% Hawaiian coffees, espresso bites, subscriptions, and more. Online at BigIslandCoffeeRoasters.com or at their cafe in Hilo.
Hawaii families love after-school care programs and need more of them. Those are the bottom lines from a new report titled America After 3 p.m. Paula Adams is the executive director of the Hawaii After School Alliance. She sat down with the Conversation's E.W. Gibson to break down the details in the report and what it all means for families trying to make ends meet.
So this report, which is called America After 3 p.m., seems to tell two stories about Hawaii. First, that lots of families are taking advantage of after-school care and really relying on it. And the second story is that a lot of families want to take advantage of after-school care but can't. So let's take that first point first. Give us a sense of how many families currently use after-school care and how does that compare to the national picture?
So in Hawaii, well, we are second in the nation of after-school participation, which is a huge win for us. And we feel very, very proud of the fact that our state is able to offer after-school programs to as many families as we can. Right now, we have around 44,000 students participating in after-school programs. And as you say, the sad news is that another 74,000 plus would like to participate in after-school program if there was an after-school program available for them.
Yeah, and so that 44,000 that do participate, that's about 23% of the kids here in Hawaii, which is really well above the national average. I think the national average for participation in after-school programs was about 13%, so much higher. So good news there. And let's stick with the good news for a minute here. So talk about the benefits of after-school programs.
Well, after-school programs has many, many, many benefits. We can start from a safe place for the kids to be. They are with responsible adults who take care of them, and they are with people who really cares for them. The other benefit is academics. After-school programs can support academically improvement from just giving time for homework, to complete homework. And some after-school programs, literally they have math and language art classes, so kids can improve their skills in those areas. And then a lot of after-school programs also have STEM activities, robotics, e-games. Some after-school programs offer meals. They offer after-school snacks. Some after-school programs offer what we call after-school supper. Literally, it's giving the students an opportunity to receive all kinds of services and help them thrive. The idea of after-school program is also that it's because it's not as a structure as a school day. Kids can explore and they can find their passion and they can find what they would like to do and what they would like to be.
Yeah, and so many elements there you touched on, academic improvement, drop in crime rates. We can actually see that in these hours where the programs are running. And as you mentioned, nutrition as well is a major factor there. So let's look at the other side of the coin. And over 74,000 children in Hawaii are missing out on after-school programs. And that, too, is below the national average. National average is 77% of kids in most states are looking for after-school programs that they can't access. Here in Hawaii, that's 63% of students that can't access. So doing better than the national average, but clearly so many families really want to engage after-school programs and aren't able to. So talk to us about what some of those barriers are that keep people from being able to utilize these programs.
Mm-hmm. I wish I could say it's one problem or one barrier, but it's a multiple factors. One thing is transportation. We know, especially in rural schools, that transportation is key for the kids to go from a school to home and vice versa. And if the school bus ends at the end of the school day at maybe 2:30, the kids have to take the bus home and they cannot stay in an after school program, even though if they want to. A few years ago, our Department of Education was thinking about adding a third route in the afternoon so the buses will pick up the kids from home first thing in the morning, drop them off at school, then pick them up, some of them, at the end of the school day, and then add a third route around 5 or 5:30 so the kids who want to stay in the after school hours can take the third bus home. That's one challenge that we are facing for certain families living, especially in rural areas. For some families, the availability of programs. One thing that we are working on is to make sure that we have enough programs in at least in all public schools in Hawaii. It's happening slowly, but I know the Department of Education is committed to make that happen, but that's another barrier for families to access after school programs. Fees is also a barrier for some families. The Alice families are these families who are living check by check and have enough money to cover the basic needs, but also their income is not high enough to receive subsidies. So those families, the fees for the after school program, when there is a fee associated to the after school programs, might be also a challenge.
Yeah, you referenced Alice families. That's an acronym for asset limited, income constrained, employed families, right? These families that fall in this middle ground you described, not living below the poverty line, but not having enough liquidity to afford the programs.
Yeah, exactly. And then there are, in some programs, there is a wait list. You know, some programs and providers are having a hard time recruiting staff and are having a hard time with retention of the staff. So those are some of the factors that are making challenges for some families to find an after-school program.
Well, and going back to that first challenge you mentioned, transportation, buses. I know that the school busing programs have faced other issues in terms of shortages of routes and so forth. And you mentioned trying to create this third route for kids that want to stay after school. Talk to us about that in real time. Is that something that you see that's front and center for the DOE right now? Is that a priority for them, you think?
Well, it was a priority a few years ago before the pandemic. With the pandemic, everything shifted. And then we had the shortage of buses. So right now, I think we need to start the conversations again about the possibility of including a third route because of challenges that our Department of Education is facing with transportation, especially finding drivers.
And so transportation is one issue, but also, as you mentioned, placement of the programs, where the programs actually are, at what schools, so that they can be reasonably accessed by the communities around those facilities. You mentioned that being an issue, and it seems like it is, as you said, more acute in rural areas. So our neighbor islands, this is something that they struggle with much more so than here on Oahu.
Yeah. So our public schools can run programs themselves, meaning that they can hire their own teachers or their own staff to run the after-school programs, or they can partner with a community-based organization. They can contract them to run the after-school programs, or they can have a mixed system where some of the activities are being offered by the teachers and some of the activities are being offered by the community-based organization. So sometimes the school have a challenge recruiting their own staff, their own teachers to run the program. Sometimes they have a challenge finding someone in the community or an organization in the community that can provide those services.
Well, and you talked about a possible solution there in terms of transportation, adding that third route. But talk to us about some of these other barriers. Are there solutions that you and your colleagues see that can help address cost of the programs and access to the programs?
Yes, cost of the programs, we could work together with our legislators, for instance, to allocate more funding for after-school programs so the cost of the programs is reduced, so families don't have to pay as much, or it could be free for all families that need an after school programs. We can leverage it also federal dollars in a different way, although right now federal dollars is
harder to combine.
It's a challenge as well, so we need to figure out that. But yeah, there are different solutions, and even though our minimum wage is above average, the nation minimum wage, the true cost of living is much higher than other states, and the livable wage is higher than the minimum wage right now. So for some workers who would love to work in after school programs, being able to afford to work on after school program is not an option. So we need also to work on the figuring out the true cost of the after school programs, and then how we can cover that true cost, so the workers and the, you know, the staff working with our kids make a livable wage.
Yeah, that goes back to that issue of retention that you were speaking about. I know the state has put a lot of resources into developing pre-K programs for everyone, universal programs, and that's something that Lieutenant Governor Luke has been working on a lot. Do you see creating more access to after-school programs as symbiotic with that, working together with that effort, or is it in competition just in terms of resources and money to go around?
Well, as I always say, we shouldn't be competing. We shouldn't be competing for something that benefits the whole community. It shouldn't be one or the other. It should be both. But we are working together with the Early Childhood Office because, as you might guess, our pre-K students and our pre-K families, they also need after-school programs because, believe it or not, families with toddlers don't end the day at 2:15. They keep working until 5.
And often those pre-K programs might end earlier even. Some of them are very truncated in the day.
So we are working with them to figure out the process on how to provide after-school program for our pre-K classrooms because those families need a safe place for those kids as well. One thing that I always wonder is if our kids, our youth, are not in an after-school programs, where are they? Where are they? You can say, okay, some of them, you know, are doing sports, some of them are home alone, some of them are on the phone, but, you know, where are they? So that's the point of offering as many opportunities for after-school programs, because we want the kids to be engaged, to have fun, to be, you know, learning. And also, if the kids are not in after school, we cannot let the street raise them. You know, we have the responsibility to take care of them. After school program gives them an opportunity to move away from the screen, to move away from a computer, and participate in sports, participate in hands-on activities, interact with other youths, have fun with other youths, socialize, build those social skills that so many of our youths lost during the whole year of the pandemic that they were inside a room in our home. So that's the beauty of after school, these opportunities for these kids that are available and for them if they want to.
Paula Adams from the Hawaii After School Alliance, thanks so much for coming and talking to us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Paula Adams of the Hawaii After School Alliance talking to HPR's D.W. Gibson about the need for more after school care across the islands. We'll have a link to the report they discussed on our website after the show.
When you want more than just the headlines, that's when you turn to The Conversation, to get the broader and deeper perspective on the stories you're following.
You know, when you have an earthquake that's that big, it was an 8.7 magnitude earthquake, that could have been a huge wave, could have been a 20 or 30 foot wave. And a few people went out toward the ocean. I gotta tell you, if this thing had just tipped a little bit differently on the seafloor, they could have been killed by a wave.
The fire was real close to Kaanapali. We could see the smoke billowing from exactly where we are, and that brought about a lot of post-traumatic experiences.
Sea level rise is essentially a permanent condition. It's going to cause flooding of many different types, and it's going to be unrelenting, accelerating, and inevitable.
Empower journalism that takes you deeper. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Before we go, it's time to serve up the answer to today's backyard quiz. On Oahu, an Aiea restaurant holds the title for longest continuously operated establishment. It began service in the 1940s after its founders returned from serving in the Army. The establishment came under new ownership in 2007, but it was said that co-founder Richard Chigami would come by the restaurant every so often and he'd tell the new owner, "Tastes good." The Chigami brothers hoped that customers would run over for the restaurant's burgers and simen in the same way that miners rushed to San Francisco to pan for gold. That's why they ended up naming their restaurant the 49er Diner. And congrats to Millie from Mo'ili'ili. You got it right. That's today's quiz. If you have one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Well, that's a wrap for today. Tomorrow, we'll be keeping an eye on the political wrangling over the federal funding to help feed needy families. Do you get assistance under the food program? How does it affect your budget? Share your story by calling our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find The Conversation as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.